Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mention WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and around the internet via the live stream capability on this radio station. Welcome to We the People, The Constitution Matters. I am your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. And I have with me today my two regular commentators, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, and Mr. Phil Duffy, instructor on the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute near Philadelphia. You'll hear from both men a little later on. Instead of calling in from my home in Yorktown, Virginia, I'm actually in Dayton, Ohio today at a reunion of a group of military aviators called the Wild Weasels. We're celebrating this weekend the 50th anniversary of the Wild Weasel mission. The Wild Weasels were formed to protect our aircraft operating over the skies of North Vietnam. Our job was to locate and either suppress or destroy the surface-to-air missiles, otherwise known as SAMs, that were shooting down our aircraft as they bombed targets in North Vietnam. Over the years, the Wild Weasels flew several different types of aircraft, from the F-100 to the F-105 that I flew to the F-16 CJ that carries on that mission today. There were over 58,000 Americans killed in the Vietnam War, an undeclared war, I might add, and some of them were my friends. 43 years and 2 days ago, on October 7th, 1972, I led a flight of Wild Weasels to a target 20 miles northwest of Hanoi. We weren't the only Weasel flight up that day, but we were successful. No friendlies were shot down that day. But a week earlier, I had watched my very own flight lead get shot down, flying no more than 1,000 feet from me. Wild Weasel Lieutenant Colonel Jim O'Neill would one day come home from Vietnam after spending a few months as a prisoner of war. His backseater, Captain Mike Basilovac, an electronic warfare officer who had administered the oath as a regular Air Force officer to me while we flew together over North Vietnam on July 4th of that year, either died or was killed in captivity. His remains were not repatriated by the North Vietnamese until September 1987. So those of us who lived to tell our tales came home to a nation where the idea of war, whether declared or undeclared, had grown out of favor. I mention all this not to let you know that the subject of war, and particularly undeclared wars, unauthorized wars, is a very personal one to me. Hopefully we'll have some time to talk about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that officially launched the Vietnam War in 1964 and the lies and the subterfuge that prompted Congress to pass it. But that's not why we're discussing this topic today. As those of you who receive my weekly essay know, we're discussing the war powers of the Constitution today because of a speech that one of my two Virginia senators, Senator Tim Kaine, gave in August at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Senator Kaine is an unabashed liberal Democrat, and I seldom pay much attention to his activities in the Senate because I know they will generally be diametrically opposed to what I would prefer he do. But in his address to Cato, which came to me by way of my monthly Cato's Letters subscription, I found myself agreeing with him, much to my surprise. You can find the video of his address on Cato's website if you're interested. Senator Kaine is highly critical of the current president, as well as his predecessor, and the Congress, for ignoring the Constitution's mandate that Congress declare war and thus be the institution to commit U.S. troops to armed conflict. He said, Congress has refused to meaningfully debate or vote on war against the Islamic State. Kaine calls our current campaign against ISIL an illegal war right now. June, acting jointly with Senator Jeff Flake, who's a Republican from Arizona, Senator Kaine introduced an authorization for the use of military force against ISIL. No one in Congress seems interested in even discussing it on either side of the aisle. Kaine warned that continued inaction by Congress is likely to transform President Obama into what he calls a perpetual war president. I actually think that point was passed long, long ago. Given this criticism, let's take a few minutes to examine what the Constitution has to say about this nation going to war, how the U.S. has waged war since 1789, and how recent administrations have approached the subject of the president's war powers. By the way, I sent an email to Senator Kaine's office asking if the senator would call in this morning to talk on this issue, and I didn't get a response. In explaining the president's war powers in Federalist 69, Alexander Hamilton tried to calm fears that they had created an imperial president with power comparable to King George. He stated, "The president will have only the occasional command of such part of the militia of the nation as by legislative provision may be called into the actual service of the Union." Hamilton then goes on to distinguish other features of the president's war powers, comparing those with a typical monarch, and basically says that the president is going to have far less war power than a typical monarch of that era. We must remember, of course, that the notion of a standing army was anathema to these men. Congress in the Constitution is only given the power to fund an army for 2 years at a time. And then there was when there was a need of an army, it would be raised, and then when no longer needed, it would be unraised and sent home. Phil Duffy will expand a little later on that. So what provisions do we have in the Constitution? Well, in Article 1, Section 8, we find that Congress has the power to declare war, to grant letters of marque and reprisal, to make rules concerning captures on the land and water, to raise and support armies in Clause 12, to support and maintain a navy, and that's a distinction, and Clause 15, to provide for calling forth the militia, and one reason is to repel invasions. So Congress has a lot of war-related power, and you can see from that that that's where the impetus in making war resides. In Article 2, Section 2, we find that the president has the authority to serve as commander-in-chief. That's it. That is his war-making power. That's all the Constitution says. In Article 4, Section 4, we also find that the United States shall protect each state against invasion. So there's a responsibility there, and the president, as commander-in-chief, bears the chief responsibility of protecting us against invasion. Now, those who argue that this too narrowly describes the president's war powers bring the vesting clause in Article 2 into play, contending that the executive power that the vesting clause gives the president of the United States implies much, much more than merely commanding troops in a war that Congress has declared. Many commentators, for example, feel that that implied in the executive power, as well as the commander-in-chief power, is the responsibility to keep the nation safe from sudden attack, which means taking offensive action when necessary to subvert an impending attack. Now, in the book Inventing the American Presidency, Thomas Cronin states, "No delegate at the 1787 ever suggested that executive power was a fountainhead of power to make war." So, what is not disputed about the war powers? Well, I think people on both sides of this argument would agree that Congress and only Congress is given the power to declare war, supply and fund and set rules for the military. And the president, as commander-in-chief, has the responsibility to lead the military in a declared war and to defend the nation against sudden attack. Those two features, I think, are undisputed. But what is disputed is whether the president can unilaterally initiate hostilities against or in a foreign country when the U.S. is not threatened without congressional approval. It all comes down, as it typically does in the Constitution, to the meaning of words. Whose meaning will we use? Well, in a 1824 letter to Henry Lee, James Madison said, "I entirely concur in the propriety of resorting to the sense in which the Constitution was accepted and ratified by the nation. In that sense alone, it is the legitimate Constitution, and if that is not the guide in expounding it, there may be no security for its faithful exercise." My friend, constitutional scholar Rob Nadelson, sent me an article yesterday in which he describes research he has conducted into the meaning of the word war. He says the founding era dictionaries and other sources, both legal and otherwise, tell us that when the Constitution was approved, war consisted of any hostilities initiated by a sovereign over opposition. A very typical dictionary definition was the exercise of violence under sovereign command against such as oppose. So what does the word declare mean? Well, since at least the year 1552, one source says the verb declare had become synonymous with the verb commence. They both meant the initiation of hostilities. Others insist today that declare is only a rhetorical device to communicate that a state of war exists. So there's quite a disparity in terms of how we see those words. But I think if we put these two words together, we find that to the founders, declaring war meant commencing hostilities against another sovereign country. The founder's favorite authority on international law, Emmerich Vattel, divided war into three principal categories: defensive wars, offensive wars, offensive just wars, that is, and offensive unjust wars. A nation fought a defensive war when it responded to an invasion. It fought a just offensive war when it responded to an infringement of its rights short of invasion. And it fought an unjust offensive war if it attacked another country, even though that other country had not infringed its rights. Examples of unjust offensive wars were those fought for conquest or to limit an innocent neighbor's power. David Whitney will speak more about just war theory a little later on in the program. Now, in a few minutes I've got left, let's turn to the August 4th, 1964 Gulf of Tonkin resolution. After President Johnson mischaracterized the attacks that had taken place on the destroyer Maddox, Congress passed the resolution. It authorized the president to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. 6 years later, amid mounting criticism of President Nixon's Cambodian excursion, the resolution was terminated in 1970. But in fact, the war had been sustained by Congress's continued military appropriations, not by the Tonkin Resolution. One commentator recently wrote, "Congress can stop the president only by passing a law that commands him to do so, but that law is subject to a presidential veto. As long as the president can get 34 senators to back him, and almost every president can, he carries the day, even if the other 501 members of Congress are opposed." So Vietnam was a watershed event, not only in respect to the president's war powers, but also in the nation's view of whether all armed conflicts are legitimate. In the years that followed, the enormity of the deception, prevarication, and subterfuge that led to Vietnam slowly became known. This led to the passage of the War Powers Resolution in 1973 that Phil Duffy will be speaking about in just a moment. The War Powers Resolution was intended to check the president's power to commit the United States to an armed conflict without the consent of the Congress, but it hasn't worked all that well, as our current war in Syria against ISIL shows. So I'm going to turn now to my friend Phil Duffy. Phil, before we go there, let's make mention that we'll be taking calls later in the show. The primary call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And if the primary number is busy, we have alternate numbers of 610-539-1783 and 1784. All first-time callers today will receive in the mail a nifty pocket constitution guaranteed to make you the hit at the office party. If the lines are tied up somehow, you can email your questions to info@1180wfyl.com. So, Phil Duffy, I'm sure you cover the topic of the war powers in your Constitution seminars at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. What is your view?
Well, first, I'm less concerned about that definition about declaring war, because basically whether declaring war is a recognition of a state of war or commencing war, the outcome is always the same, and that is that a nation goes to war. You know, there are military operations that are involved. So That's not the concern, I don't think. I think the real concern is initiating war without constitutional authority. And that, of course, is what our session is about. So let's get into that argument that the president is responsible to keep the nation safe from sudden attack, which means taking offensive action when necessary to subvert an attack. I think that's remarkable that proponents of this view base their claim on Article II's vesting statement. And let me just go over that again. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. So what is an executive power? According to the principle of separation of powers, which is fundamental to the construction of our Constitution, it is a power to execute measures that have been determined by the legislative branch, Congress. So the argument breaks down immediately. That aside, could the president possibly have the responsibility to keep the nation safe from sudden attack? And that would take godlike powers, as we learned at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. The harsh reality is that a determined enemy can find a way to hurt us, but that is a long way from defeating us, and most potential enemies are not stupid. Certainly not nation states. They know that retribution will be on its way. So let's go back to Pearl Harbor to demonstrate that, to the contrary, a president can never be involved in defense against a sudden attack. We've heard the Pearl Harbor, story so often, or perhaps have seen Torah, Torah, Torah. Can anybody remember someone in our armed forces calling Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Washington to ask permission to shoot back at the Japanese? My point is the responsibility for defense against a sudden attack is always the responsibility of the local commander and never the responsibility of the President of the United States unless the President is personally attacked. And what if any other individual is suddenly attacked? What right does that person have? It's the right of self-defense. The right of self-defense is inherent in our human nature. It derives from the natural law. So what authority does any executive in any government have concerning war outside of defense? That depends upon the foundation law of the nation. In the United States, that foundation law is the Constitution of the United States. The power to declare war, that is, to initiate military action against another nation, is clearly vested in the legislative branch, Congress. Lest there be any doubt, Hamilton made clear the intent of Article 1, Section 8 on the declaration of war in the Federalist Number 69. But suppose we did not have that separation of powers, and the power to determine if the nation would go to war with another nation lay with the executive. That has happened quite often throughout history. We have a spectacular case with the steps that led to Germany going to war with Poland in 1939. Hitler had the power to make the war call, but even he realized it would not sit too well with the German people, so he cooked up a fake incident on the German-Polish border in an operation called Canned Goods. Members of the SS were stationed near the German-Polish border to carry out a simulated Polish attack on the German radio station at Gliwice. The plan called for SS men dressed in Polish army uniforms to do the shooting, and drug concentration camp inmates were to be left dying as casualties. The plan was executed, and Hitler used this as evidence that Poland had attacked Germany first. Therefore, he was required to respond. And Hitler did not need to get permission from the Reichstag to invade Poland. He possessed that power already to protect the German people against sudden attack. So some may claim that this sort of thing could never happen here, but I've seen a lot of things I would never have expected over my lifetime, and I'm not so sure. In any case, it is well established that national political executives are tempted to go to war. A congressional declaration of war is a reasonable check on what could be a dangerous power if left only in the hands of the executive. We hear a lot these days about the danger of sudden attack. 9/11 is evidence that such attacks are possible, although 9/11 attacks were not initiated by nation states. Mature nation states, however, are considerably less likely to initiate a preemptive strike against the United States because of the potential for retaliation. What nation state wants to take on the United States, which has been reported to expend more on the military than the next 10 countries combined? In our situation, is our situation special because we are less defensible than other nations? I mean, that's an argument that could be raised. Arguably, the United States is the most naturally defensible nation on Earth. Compare us with nations such as China and Russia, which have extensive land borders with 14 not-so-friendly neighbors. We're geographically blessed, since the United States encompasses a large landmass bordered by the two largest oceans and the Gulf of Mexico. What land borders we have are with non-militarily threatening neighbors. This is something that Alexis de Tocqueville noted as early as 1840, when his classic Democracy in America was first published. There should always be enough time for Congress to consider initiating hostile action with another country. Therefore, the declaration of war is the appropriate measure. If I could make a comment about the War Powers Resolution of 1973, in my opinion, this contradicts the Constitution's requirement that wars be initiated by congressional declaration of war. The Wikipedia entry for the resolution indicates that the War Powers Resolution, that's an interesting term, resolution, of 1973, is a federal law intended to check the president's power to commit the United States to an armed conflict without the consent of the U.S. Congress. The resolution was adopted in the form of the United States Congress Joint Resolution. It provides that the U.S. president can send U.S. armed forces into action abroad only by declaration of war by Congress, statutory authorization, or in case of a national emergency created by attack upon the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. So a little historical background should help us understand the resolution. We'd been increasingly involved in Vietnam for 17 years at that point, and we're looking for a way to extract ourselves. We previously had been involved in Korea, fighting the forces of North Korea and Communist China to a draw. There had been no declaration of war in either engagement. On the other hand, we were involved in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and we truly believe the Soviet Union had the ability to inflict significant and immediate nuclear damage on the United States, so it was felt we needed to be able to react quickly to an emergency. Prior to the resolution, we had four major conflicts, but subsequent to the resolution, we've had 11. None of which have been associated with a declaration of war. So it is obvious that the resolution has done nothing to inhibit the executive branch from going to war. Let's consider that wording in the resolution. A national emergency created by an attack upon the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. Think about that. This is a lawyer's dream and a citizen's nightmare. Who determines if national emergency conditions have been met? It appears this is a judgment to be made by the president. But that is precisely the mechanism employed in the Weimar Constitution, which allowed Adolf Hitler to rise to power in 1933. It also faces Congress with a presidential fait accompli. How can Congress reverse military operations that have already been undertaken? History has demonstrated Congress is unable to do that. So the fundamental flaw in the War Powers Resolution of 1973 is that it really gives the executive branch additional cover for initiating unauthorized wars in spite of its publicized intent.
Well, that's about all the time we have before our mid-break. We'll be back in a few minutes after these commercial words with more discussion on this topic.
Tri-state area. Street. dream of freedom, shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station, WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. The Nobel Peace Prize goes to a group of four organizations that help start democracy in Tunisia.
The Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet, for its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia.
The announcement in Oslo, Norway, protests in Tunisia, that's North Africa, started the Arab Spring movement to overthrow dictators 4 years ago. There were 273 nominees for this year's Peace Prize. Four people shot early this morning at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff.
The four victims included one dead and three wounded. The shooter is in custody.
Eric Dieter leads the school's public information officer. The shooting happened in a parking lot outside a dormitory about 3 hours ago. No word yet what the motive might have been, the condition of the other people shot, or if these were all students. Fox News, we report. You decide.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. Encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
A nation of well-informed men who have been taught to know and prize the rights which God has given them cannot be enslaved. It is in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins. A quote from Benjamin Franklin.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm Gary Porter, your host. We're examining the question of whether the Congress or the President has constitutional power to make war. That is, which branch of the federal government can commit U.S. forces to hostility. I mentioned in my remarks the difference between just war and unjust war, as Emmerich Vattel in his Law of Nations expounded. And I think David Whitney's going to tell us a little bit more about that, as well as his other views on this topic. David, what is your view of the constitutional power to go to war?
Oh, thank you, Gary. And by the way, let me be one to say thank you for serving our country in Vietnam. I know it was a very unpopular war. Many, when they came back, were spit upon and disrespected in many ways, which was awful. The conflict that we were embroiled in there raised a lot of questions that I think, as Phil has said, really the War Powers Act hasn't resolved those questions, because we've been embroiled in many more conflicts around the world, and now we're supposedly embroiled in a conflict not even against another enemy that is a sovereign nation, because we were not attacked at 9/11 by any sovereign nation whatsoever, but by a bunch of terrorists. So Now we have a war on terror, which actually isn't even an object, a being. It's an enemy tactic. Terror is not so that we're kind of embroiled in an endless war. I think it was John McCain said, "Oh, this is the 100-year war." It's like, "Oh, please, get us out of this." When we think about the war issues that we've talked about already, the big question is, what constitutes a just war? And just war theory is an area of theology that has been wrestled with by Christians all the way back to the beginning of when you see the first Christian countries arise. Obviously, when the early Christians came to faith in Christ, they were a minority in the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire persecuted them and hounded them until the Roman Empire fell, and basically it was the Christians that were the ones to restore any semblance of order. And the idea of just war is, what does God's Word teach us about what is a proper response? Phil has already mentioned that, obviously, there's always the biblical admonition we have of self-defense. If someone attacks me as an individual, I have every right. In fact, I have a duty given to us in the Sixth Commandment that says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder. The opposite of that, included in that command, is that I am duty-bound to protect my life unless there is some higher calling that God has involved me in, say, to be a martyr or something. That I am, the default position is that I am to defend my life from attack by another person who, with deadly force, is seeking to take my life. And so, obviously, that same principle applies at the national level, that if a nation is attacked with deadly force by another sovereign power, then its response would be to defend itself from attack, and that attack is normally understood as invasion of one's borders. That is, an army has crossed the border, an army has come into the country, or an army is attacking towns who are on the beach, so to speak. So anywhere the border is invaded or attacked, then we have a just response of killing those attackers. In fact, I think in the war between the states, it was a proper response on the part of General Jackson to say, no quarter. That is, these people have invaded our country. They are attacking us and killing us. Therefore, we have no duty to give them quarter if we meet them on the battlefield. We can kill them, and there's no surrender on their part that would change that. Now, that's, I know, a bit of a controversial statement, but it's like this. If someone were to come into your house at night, biblical text is Exodus chapter 21, if they break into your house at night, you can kill them because you're not certain whether they have deadly intent or not. During the daytime, you may be able to see whether they have a weapon in their hand or no weapon in their hand. But when somebody invades your country, the only reason they would be invading your country is to kill, maim, steal, destroy, and plunder. And so you have every right to take the life of everyone that invades your country. And this just war theory then has to also answer the questions, what about potential attacks? What about the idea of preemptive strikes? That is, we see a nation gathering its armies on our borders. And do we have a God-given power in that situation to attack them before they attack us? And in the just war theory, of course, there's divergent views. There's a couple different theories as to how that is handled. One theory says, of course, you have every right to attack them if you see that they are about to attack you. And the other view would say, no, not until they either draw first blood or they cross the border in an invasion attempt. It's only then, at that point, that you have the right, in a sense, to pull the trigger. I liken what took place at Lexington and Concord as a good illustration of the working out and the wrestling with the just war theory. By the way, that militia were all members of the church there that was on Lexington Green. The pastor was part of that militia. The leadership of the militia, all of those were Christians who wrestled with these things, and they were given the instructions, do not fire first. That is, do not preemptively fire at the British, even though they have invaded. You know, they're here in the town, and we know that their purpose here is to come and confiscate all of our weapons and make us defenseless so they can enslave us or kill us. But do not fire first. Do not be the one to draw first blood, because Scripture exhorts us not to do harm to another unless they have initiated. And so it was, at least the reports we have, is that the British opened fire first, and not even certain in the confusion of all that took place there whether there was a command to fire or whether British soldiers were acting, you know, trigger happy and actually just fired without having been given command. Irregardless, the British were the ones that fired first, and the colonials responded properly with return fire, taking life, you know, in deadly aim. And then, of course, what took place in the rest of that battle was primarily the success of the American colonists was sniper fire from the trees and so forth along the roads as the British hastily returned to Boston to lick their wounds. So all of this really comes back to the question is, what is the purpose of war? If war's purpose is to take territory that you don't currently possess, I believe that's a violation of God's law and a violation of the just war theory, that you do not aggressively attack others and take territory or take control of their territory. Rather, you are sitting in a position where your desire is to defend your own borders. Thinking about that in light of the, you know, the history since World War II, I would say up to World War II, primarily, we were following the just war theory. You could argue as well in World War II that we were doing so in addition. But following World War II, something dramatically changed. As it's already been mentioned, I believe there has not been a congressional declaration of war since World War II. So if you hold to the idea that the Congress must declare war, we haven't done it since World War II. And what we've been embroiled in since World War II is quite clear. If you were to look at it just from a historical perspective, try not to be nationalistic and say, well, our country's right or wrong. No, but just from a worldwide perspective, historical perspective, what shifted after World War II is America developed the American Empire, no longer the American Republic, that is, we're just concerned about our territory. Instead, after World War II, we thought we became the policemen of the world, that we had to do all these things to guard the borders of other nations. And, you know, so we got involved in the Korean conflict, and we've been guarding, how many years is that? Over 50 years now, we've been guarding the border between Korea, North and South Korea. We've been guarding their border perfectly, yet we can't even guard our own southern border. There's something wrong with that set of priorities. But we have become an empire with military bases in 140 nations of the world. That's the definition of an empire. And military extending boots on the ground in many, many of those countries, and then involved in all kinds of conflicts within those countries. You know, our CIA, I think an unconstitutional organization altogether, deposing one ruler in Iran and imposing the Shah of Iran, getting involved in that. That was a huge, huge mistake. That was not just at all to be intermeddling in the government of another country and setting up a puppet government, which eventually the people of Iran got fed up with the puppet government and overthrew the Shah of Iran, and then we know the rest of the history there with the Ayatollah and so on. But what has happened is we've shifted from saying our military forces are going to be used to defend our borders to saying, no, our military forces are now going to be used on an international scale to interrupt conflicts and create conflicts all over the world, in a sense trying to run the world. When you say you are the world's policeman, essentially you are the ones who runs the entire world and must govern and control every nation in the world. That's not a biblical understanding of law and government, and obviously that's not a constitutional principle that we are supposed to be following in what we do with the powers granted to our federal government. So we have stepped way out of bounds of the just war theory as a nation, and I believe part of our disastrous problems and part of our economic problems, and you consider the billions of dollars every month being spent on this war on terror, much of those problems, if we just accept the analysis of the 9/11 Commission, I think there's a lot of flaws in their analysis, but essentially the 9/11 Commission speaks about blowback from our foreign policy, having intermeddled in the countries of 140 countries of the world, and those intermeddlings are seen by the people in those countries as what they are. America is messing with our government, which is a, you know, an aggressive, attacking kind of stance. Even if we're not militarily attacking, we're messing and intermeddling with their government. That is something that is offensive, and rightly offensive to them, because it attacks the sovereignty of their nation. And so those sovereign nations have individuals within them that have chosen to become terrorists, and we face the blowback from a foreign policy that has shifted from America being a republic that defends its own borders and sees that its borders are secure, which obviously our borders are not secure, and we're not even defending our own borders, to an international intermeddler in other people's business where really our nose does not belong in other people's business. So when we say, what's the solution to this? Well, I believe the solution, in my opinion, again, many might vehemently disagree with me, but is to draw back from being an empire and say, no, we need to concern ourselves with our constitutional republic. Obviously, we're not even defending our own borders or are guarding our own borders. We need to not be the world's policeman any longer, but nonetheless continue military preparedness to be ready when there is an attack that comes against us. And I think we will lower the level of attacks that we have seen if we stop intermeddling in the affairs of other countries, which means our CIA needs to be largely disbanded and reduced to just information gathering, not involved in all the intrigue in other countries and assassinations and overthrows and all the things that our CIA has. We need to repent of those sins of not following the just war theory and essentially apologize to these other countries for the damages that we have done to them and to their governments, not recognizing the sovereignty of their governments. I don't know really what's, in my view, behind this push to keep America as the world's policeman is the push actually to develop a one-world government, and that America is being used and our wealth is being used and our military is being used not really for the good of America, but for the good of those who want to destroy the sovereignty of every nation in the world and force them all into a new world order, as Bush has famously called it, that would supposedly somehow secure peace by having a world military. And we know where that would lead because given fallen human sinful nature, whoever is going to be in control of that world military is going to be a ruthless dictator, not one who secures the God-given rights of the people.
Well, thanks, David, for that rundown. And I agree entirely with your just war theory and how we should be applying it today. And you're right that we've only declared war since officially since World War II. We had five declared wars by Congress: the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and World War II. Now, in Korea, when we came to Korea, President Truman decided that a UN authorization was all that he needed to initiate hostilities or to respond to the hostilities of North Korea. And eventually the Chinese. So he didn't even ask Congress to declare war. And that came out to bite him later on when he tried to take over the steel mills. The Supreme Court rebuffed him, saying that, well, you didn't have a declaration of war, so you weren't in a war condition, therefore you couldn't exercise that executive power. So the declaration of war is immensely important because it has attachments to it that are incredibly important. But since Truman's precedent-setting attempt to initiate hostilities without a declaration of war, then the other presidents since then have taken that to his example and said, "Well, if it worked for Harry Truman, it'll work for me." And we've seen presidents, both Republican and Democrat, basically initiate hostilities without getting Congress involved. We had Grenada, we had Panama, we had Serbia, and just the list is almost endless of hostilities and lives lost because presidents decided they didn't need Congress's declaration of war as their cover. So the whole problem here, I think, revolves around whether the American people should allow this to continue. They are, in fact, the government, in a sense. They are, it's a government of we the people, and they are only supposed to allow things to go on that that they're comfortable with. But the American people are so withdrawn from their government and so disconnected from it that they really don't follow what's happening, and nor do they seem to care. So this is going to continue. Until somebody wakes up. Phil Duffy, what do you think the American people need to do given the current situation?
Well, I think that they're going to have to recognize the bogus isolationist argument that is constantly being used. The idea for those who promote that argument is let's label these guys as kooks. They want to go back to 200 years ago when the nation was founded, and things have changed and so forth and so on. It's a global world. We should be involved and so forth. And the point of that is that people who do not want to be want this nation to be the world's policeman are not isolationists. They're deeply involved in the world. They want the United States to be a responsible actor in the world. And what does that come down to? It really comes down to establishing an example for the rest of the world. We drew those people to our nation because they saw the principles of government and the way we lived here. We prospered. And we were peaceful, and that's what drew immigrants to the United States. They could flee from the conflicts in Europe in particular, and now the rest of the world. All we need to do is to set the right example, I believe, for the rest of the world. We don't have to be the master race. There's nothing exceptional in that sense about a United States citizen. I think it's what makes us exceptional is the rule of law, which is based upon the Constitution. We need to follow it.
Well, thanks, and I agree. But what, as an individual citizen, listening to this broadcast, what do they need to do if they are upset at the way this country is proceeding, the way this government is proceeding with its war powers?
Well, I think our direct representatives, of course, are our House and Senate. I'm pleased that you said your senator seems to understand these principles and is not pleased with what Barack Obama has done in office.
Well, one of my two senators.
Yes, one of them. So communicating with our direct representatives to say we need to change this. They have the power of the purse, so obviously they have some influence over what's going to take place in the spending categories, and we're spending billions of dollars a month, money that obviously we don't have, that we're borrowing from who knows who at this point in time to continue this war on terror that so far is completely unsuccessful. We just look at what's happened this week. Supposedly we were fighting ISIL, ISIS, or whoever you want to identify that group over there, and we're doing everything we could, but our hands are tied. Look at Russia. They go in and in 3 days, you know, they bomb a whole bunch, and they destroy a whole bunch, and look, you know, something is wrong with this picture. It's as if our military really didn't want to act there. But the question is, should we even be doing that? Should we even be messing with trying to overthrow Syria, like we're supporting the rebels that want to overthrow Assad and fighting against ISIS that wants to overthrow? Why are we doing that? That, I don't believe, is in our best interest to be even engaged in nation building, as we did with Libya, and on the list goes of things where we've gotten involved, and the American people, like you say, Gary, they're disconnected. It's like, well, you see that on the news, and it has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with us, because it hits us in our pocketbook as we continue to spend billions upon billions we don't have, that we're becoming debt slaves. That is, not only will we be paying this debt our whole life, our children will be paying, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. We may be debt slaves for generations that have yet to be born because of the decisions being made today by those in Congress. And so we need to appeal to those who are our direct representatives, and obviously we need to be involved in the process of choosing the next president, because if we get another warmonger who wants to conquer the whole world, and there are some who definitely are talking that way, running currently for the White House, we need to be involved in preventing a warmonger from assuming the presidency.
Well, as Senator King pointed out in his address, though, he has introduced an AUMF. The president, in fact, sent an AUMF, a draft one, to Congress, and I think that is essentially what Senator Kaine introduced in the summer of this year, and Congress doesn't seem willing to debate it. Now, we know we have this leadership chaos in the Republican side of the House of Representatives, and that is a big distraction, but When your representatives won't even debate the issue of whether an authorization for military force is warranted, what can the American people do then?
Well, we're in a tough spot because, you know, much of what Washington does is unaccountable to us and beyond our reach in terms of, well, we could appeal to, as you say, even our own representatives may be doing the right thing, but the rest of Congress is not. What I think needs to happen is we need to wake up America all across the nation. Last weekend, I spent some time in South Dakota with patriots there, seeking to awaken them to the action they can take locally as well as at the federal level. My work at Institute on the Constitution is designed to do exactly that, to help awaken people to understand issues like we're discussing this morning and the constitutionality of those issues so that they can speak intelligently to hundreds of other people, wake them up, and ultimately, if the people, the American people, arise and say, we've had it with this, you in the House, if you will not do a constitutional action regarding the war, we are going to throw you out. We can elect you and re-elect you every 2 years, but we're going to throw you out of office. Senators, of course, it's much harder because they're a six-year term, but unless the American people awaken to the issues and step forward to make a change, and I think John Boehner might be one of those examples where we are making change. That section of Ohio where you're actually at currently, Gary, we've graduated more students from Institute on the Constitution in the last three and a half years, over 3,000 graduates, and those are all in Boehner's district. And because they know, wow, the Constitution and talk about the Constitution to their friends, family, neighbors, people look to them when it comes to election time. Who are you voting for? To take their advice. So the influence of that 3,000 is far greater than just their sheer numbers. Last primary for Boehner's position, he was running scared. In fact, he had to pull out all kinds of dirty tricks to defeat his opponent. And his opponent, by the way, is running again. I think maybe Boehner saw the handwriting on the wall, saw that he is not likely to win in the next primary, and so that was part of his calculus in making his decision to resign as Speaker of the House. We can make a difference, but we've got to teach people what our Constitution says.
We obviously have to get people awakened, and until we do, nothing is going to change. Let me, in the time we've got remaining here, tell you about an event coming up on October 19th. At the Foundation for American Christian Education, Dr. Max Lyons will be discussing his book, Government Takes All, What's Left for Me. You can join us online via live stream or in the classroom. Benjamin Rush, one of my favorite founders in 1787, said, "The American War is over, but this is far from being the case with the American Revolution. On the contrary, nothing but the first act of the drama is closed. It remains yet to establish and perfect our new forms of government and to prepare the principles, morals, and manners of our citizens for these forms of government after they are established and brought to perfection." So we'll see you next week on We the People. Bring a friend.
Senior citizens mention WFIL, receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, friends. Janet Parshall here, host of In the Market with Janet Parshall. Join me every Sunday at 12.05 p.m. on 1180 a.m. WFYL, working for your liberty and things that matter, right here in the Cradle of Liberty area, Valley Forge and Philadelphia.